Our 11:30, what was scheduled is an 11:30 argument. We're now ready to begin with our 12:05 argument. So, Madam Marshal, I'll ask you to check and see if council might perhaps be out in the hallway. The court extends its appreciation to counsel for appellant and respondent for being here in advance of your scheduled argument time. It is much appreciated by the court. Please take a few moments, settle in at the table. I will ask the marshal to call the case, but don't feel in any hurry. So go ahead, Marshal.
And again. I made that fashion statement with the boot for quite a while. What did you break something?
I fractured my foot.
The fifth metatarsal, or?
I think it was the third or fourth. Like, I can't recall which one, but I mean, I'm also pregnant, so I think it was like the weight.
You didn't go down on. You didn't go down on this ice, did you? That we had this winter. Okay. Last matter for us on our oral argument calendar, we have another non-oral matter, is ready. The marshal has called the case, and I see counsel are at table. I will just say just a few things. You're probably aware of both of these, but I just want to remind you. So first of all, when you approach the podium, take your time to bring whatever materials you want, a glass of water, set yourself up, and adjust the podium so that it's comfortable for you. It does go up and down, and also you can move that microphone around, and it's really just to make sure that we can hear the conversation that we're going to have with you. And then the second thing I'll remind you to do is to identify yourself for the record as well as your client before you begin your remarks. So with that, if the appellant is ready, you can proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Caitlin Rose Fisher, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Andrew Heiderscheid, and I'm appearing as a special assistant state public defender. Now, we've raised two issues on appeal. The first is whether the district court erred in denying Mr. Heiderscheid's motion to suppress, and the second is whether the district court abused its discretion in its sentence of Mr. Heiderscheid. Now, today, I'd like to focus on the first issue, and specifically within that issue, why Mr. Heiderscheid's warrantless arrest was unlawful. I'm, of course, happy to answer the court's questions on all issues presented by the case, however. So as this court is well aware, warrantless arrests are presumptively unreasonable, and the burden is on the state to show that the arrest complies with both statutory and constitutional law. And the arrest in this case complied with neither. And I'd like to address both. And I'm going to start with the statutory issue. In this case, officers arrested Mr. Heiderscheid immediately following a traffic stop without being able to identify any particular felony that had occurred.
Do you agree that the stop was based on reasonable and articulable suspicion?
No, Your Honor. We contest the stop because we believe that the 911 caller was not sufficiently reliable, but that is based on a disagreement with the factual findings in the district court. So if this court were to adopt the district court's factual findings, then in that case, it's a much closer question whether the stop was reasonable. But our challenge to the stop is based on an argument that, again, the district court's factual findings were clearly erroneous and the caller was not sufficiently reliable. And I believe that's well covered in our briefs. I'm happy to discuss why we believe that's the case, but I'm also happy to assume that this, if this court were to agree with the district court's factual findings and conclude that there was a stop, then even if you accept all of that as being true, the arrest is deficient as a matter of statutory and constitutional law. So again, returning to the statute, I believe Minnesota's warrantless arrest statute, which is Minnesota statute section 629.34, unambiguously requires that a particular felony has in fact occurred before officers arrest someone without a warrant on reasonable cause for having committed that felony. And this follows directly from the plain text of the statute. And we're talking today about subdivision 1C3, which is the subdivision that was identified by the district court. And that subdivision has two separate clauses. And the first clause is that a felony has in fact been committed. In fact.
So you interpret that as a different standard from probable cause, is the way I read your brief.
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, if you just look at its plain meaning, I believe we cite the definition in Black's Law Dictionary, means an actuality, not hypothetically.
Well, does it mean an actuality at the time, as the officer knows, has information at the time of the arrest, or are we looking backwards in time and saying, we have a determination that we now have a determination that a crime was or wasn't committed?
Prospectively, and we know that because...
Prospectively from the officer's point of view, I mean, objective, obviously not subjective, but objective point of view at the time of the arrest.
Correct.
Whatever information the officer had.
Correct. Okay. We believe that the statute sets forth the conditions that have to exist at the time of the arrest. In other words, just like in the constitutional context, a search that doesn't comply or an arrest that doesn't comply with the statute isn't saved just by, you know, whatever evidence is uncovered later.
So help me out. How is that different from probable cause?
Well, we know it's different from probable cause because if you look at the second subdivision or the second clause of subdivision 1C3, it says, and there has to be reasonable cause for believing the person arrested to have committed it, with it being the felony.
No, I did follow your statutory analysis. What I'm struggling with is the way our case law has treated, mm-hmm. Whether an arrest is lawful or not lawful. Most of our case law focuses on probable cause for the arrest. In fact, I'm struggling to find one that, you know, illustrates your point of view of the statute. Help me out there if you've got it.
Absolutely, and I struggle to find that as well. There just are not a lot of cases interpreting this statute, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't apply.
And I understand that, but yeah. The point I'm trying to get to is when I hear you describe what is proving that a felony, in fact, was committed, we're going to look at it at the time of the arrest, the information available to the officer. I'm guessing the next part of your answer would be that a crime was committed and that a defendant committed the crime.
Correct. So the standard that we believe applies is...
So how is that different from probable cause? I'm missing the next part. If that's the way you would articulate the test
right.
for this part of the statute.
So probable cause is a strong suspicion, right, that a crime has been committed. And we believe that this has to be more than that, more than a strong suspicion, and at a minimum.
So you're talking about preponderance?
Sufficiency
doubt,
of the evidence, or? Something closer okay. to not necessarily beyond a reasonable doubt, but something, it has to be something higher than probable cause. And we know that because otherwise subdivision 1C2 and 1C3 are completely superfluous. They would say the exact same thing if in fact means
probable cause. Would you commit yourself? I mean, since you've already acknowledged you don't have any case law.
Yes.
So you're asking this court to make a decision based on the statute and adopt a new standard for a lawful arrest. Mm-hmm. So what would the standard be? Is it, because you've already said several of them, so which one is it?
Sufficient evidence.
Okay.
That a felony has occurred. And at a minimum, what we would say is that officers have to be able to identify a specific felony.
Well, we do have testimony from the officers identifying specific felonies at the time they arrested Mr. Edwards.
Specific felonies. They can't identify any specific felony. And I think the fact that officers are hypothesizing about a wide range of potential felonies that may have occurred.
Well, they all sound pretty related to me, counsel.
The felonies?
Right. Well, the felonies identified. And, of course, we all know that multiple felonies can be implicated by the same conduct.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I strongly disagree that you know, the district court hypothesized that there could have been a attempted homicide, and officers also testified that it could have just been trespassing. I strongly disagree that the same set of facts should give rise to reasonable suspicion or probable cause
assault
that the exact
based
same
on,
two.
What about assault based on the facts that were known to the officers at the time? Because that's one of the felonies that they identified when they were asked. On what basis did you arrest Mr. Edwards?
Right, so we believe that there wasn't probable cause that an assault would have occurred. And I guess I'll shift. So let's say that this court disagrees with our statutory analysis. I mean, shifting to the constitutional question, what we effectively have here is a case where officers inverted the proper order of operations. Officers are supposed to conduct an investigation and, based on that investigation, determine whether a suspicion rises to the level of a strong suspicion. And here, again, of course, this is based on the totality of the circumstances, and it fundamentally is a judgment call, but we strongly disagree that based on the information that officers had at the time of the arrest, the threshold was crossed from a suspicion of wrongdoing to a strong suspicion of wrongdoing.
Except that if they had gotten a warrant, an arrest warrant, it would have said, Officer so-and-so has probable cause to believe that this person has committed a crime, and here are the facts, and this is the crime. And so in criminal law, it goes from reasonable articulable suspicion to probable cause for an arrest, and conviction is beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. So your strong suspicion,
that's probable,
whatever you're calling it, mm-hmm. I don't hear that in the lexicon of criminal law.
That is absolutely the standard for a warrantless arrest. For there to be probable cause for a warrantless arrest, and this is in Flowers, this is in plenty of decisions, officers have to have an honest and strong suspicion that a crime has been committed
That's
by the defendant.
That's probable cause. That's the definition of probable cause?
Correct. I'm sorry. And apologies if I wasn't clear. I've shifted now to the constitutional analysis. So we believe that something more than that. At a minimum, under the statute, officers have to be able to identify a specific felony. I'm not necessarily saying that that's the case in the constitutional analysis. I agree that there are plenty of cases where officers do hypothesize about a range of potential felonies that have occurred, and a court may conclude that there is probable cause. What we take issue with in this case is how broad the range of potential crimes was in this case. And we think the fact that there is such a wide range of potential crimes demonstrates just the very fact that there was just a suspicion of wrongdoing. There was no actual strong suspicion of wrongdoing to satisfy the warrantless arrest probable cause standard.
To be fair, isn't this a developing situation? I mean, and police certainly have to consider the facts as they're coming into them. The officers that testified at the hearing were quite clear that they were getting new information as things moved on. And there was a weapon involved. There were officer safety concerns.
And officers have plenty of tools available to them in those circumstances. Officers, again, could have conducted an investigatory stop in this case. If you accept the district court's factual findings as true, they could have patted, as they did, Mr. Heiderscheid for weapons. They could have asked if he would engage in a conversation with them. But they didn't do those things. Instead, they immediately, based solely on a 911 call that there was an individual in a garage with a gun who then drove away.
Stranger in the garage with a gun.
Absolutely. That is a factual finding that we take issue with.
Right, but that's not why we're here today, right? At least not at this stage of the analysis. So when we get to probable cause under the Constitution, we've gotten to a certain point, right?
Correct. So a stranger in the garage with a gun.
And okay. The brother has warned the sister, not safe, you need to leave.
That's actually not in the record.
Well, I think the officers did get the information that she had fled the scene at some point during this. You know, as I said, it's a developing scene and a situation.
It absolutely is. There isn't any statement in the record that at any point anyone felt unsafe. They just left the house because there's an individual, a reported individual with a gun in the garage. But then that individual leaves.
Now, you know, officers are entitled, based on their experience, to draw some inferences. And given the 911 call, I mean, is it a fair inference for the officers to conclude that this is not a welcome stranger with a gun in the garage?
That
you wouldn't let an officer do that based on their experience?
Well, even if he wasn't welcome in the garage, that's still not necessarily a felony. In order for there to be trespassing, someone has to be told to leave.
And what's missing for assault?
Fear. A reasonable, and apologies, I don't know that statute off the top of my mind, but my understanding is that it would be some sort of a fear or a threatening.
And what's
of
missing
harm.
For burglary?
Apologies?
What's missing for burglary? And I don't mean to put you on the spot, counsel, but I guess what you've attacked the case that's been made in the statements of the officers at the hearing as listing too many felonies, which is, it's an interesting argument, listing too many felonies as opposed to zeroing in on one and finding fault with that. And so I guess I'm just struggling to see where, what would have been sufficient to create probable cause if this wasn't.
So any indicia that there had been something in addition to there being an individual in the gun with a garage. There is no evidence of a threat. There is no evidence of property being missing. Officers aren't provided with any of that information. And I think the key is not just that there's a range of potential crimes that could have been committed, but the fact that officers can't actually identify any particular crime. And I direct the court to Lieutenant Sturgeon's testimony. I mean, the hearing transcript is replete with examples of this, but Sturgeon's testimony at page 27, he says, there's a question, okay, and what crime was, or apologies, answer, that is the crime if you're in a garage with a gun. Okay, that's not necessarily a felony. Question, and what crime was, would that be a person ineligible to possess a firearm? Answer, that could be one. It could be trespassing, especially if they're inside the garage. Also not a felony. With the information we were given, we knew that there was another person in there, the caller's brother, and there could have been an assault at that time. I don't know. I didn't know at that time. Again, an honest and strong suspicion that a felony has been committed. And this court has made clear that in close cases, the lack of a warrant, the presumption that, warrantless arrest is presumptively unreasonable, in close cases, the lack of a warrant can weigh against probable cause. If this isn't a close case, I just don't know what is, especially when you couple it with Mr. Heiderscheid's conduct immediately following the stop, which the district court concluded was indicia of guilt. And respectfully, Your Honors,
no, honestly,
I completely
disagree.
That's
not how I interpreted the district court's comments or the arguments that have been made. It was that they had the right guy, that based on the fact that he put his hands outside and claimed to be a victim, was in the red minivan, indicated to them they had the right minivan and the right guy who had the weapon, as opposed to that he was guilty, but they had the right individual.
But that doesn't lend additional probable cause that individual
had actually committed. Well, it's an aspect of probable cause, though, isn't it? Because I have to find the same person who was in the garage with the gun.
Right, but respectfully, I think that, first of all, someone putting their hands outside of their window today when pulled over at gunpoint by officers is, I think that that's just reasonable. That's what lots of people are told to do. And identifying oneself as a victim just further demonstrates there was a need for investigation in this case, not a need to jump the gun and arrest Mr. Heiderscheid. I see I'm out of time. I'll save the remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
And you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Connor Kremens. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney. I'm the respondent in this case. May it please the court. And there are two issues on appeal here. The first issue relates to the Fourth Amendment issues as it relates to the stop, the arrest, the search of the appellant and the appellant's vehicle. The second issue relates to the appellant's sentence. As it relates to the Fourth Amendment issues here, I want to first start with the standard of review. As this court's aware, when a suppression motion is on appeal, the standard of review is that the court may independently review the facts and then look at those facts to see if As a matter of law, reasonable suspicion has been met, probable cause has been met, or whatever the appropriate legal standard. I think it's important to emphasize that the facts will be accepted unless they're clearly erroneous. And the facts that are pertinent here are the facts that came about from the contested omnibus hearing, the testimony of the two officers. There were no additional exhibits offered at that particular hearing. It was simply the testimony of those officers. I believe the appellant's brief inappropriately cites the facts that are outside of that record. It cites the facts that came about in the stipulated facts trial, where evidence was submitted as it relates to guilt or innocence. It's inappropriately procedurally because the district court, those facts were not before the district court when it made its determination on the suppression motion. It's also inappropriately cited too because those particular facts, specifically the interview with the brother of the reporting party, those facts were not available to the officers at the time that they made the decisions.
That happened after the stop and search.
Correct. So at the time of the stop, the search, the arrest, that information wasn't available to the officers, and that comes out in the contested omnibus hearing in terms of it was never brought up. Defense counsel never cross-examined anyone on that particular report because it was irrelevant. It wasn't part of what the officers' decisions were at the time that they stopped, they arrested, they searched. The state's position is that the officers' conduct was reasonable, Your Honors. It was reasonable to stop the appellant. As the court's aware, reasonable articulable suspicion is a low threshold. An objective basis exists.
I want to make sure that I understand what facts were available to the court at the time of the omnibus. So you have the 911 call, and then you have the guy who flags the officers down and points. It says, I've been following the van. There it is.
Yes, Your Honor. But the 911 call, there was sort of a lot to unpack with the 911 call. But yes, those are the two items.
And then his behavior when the car was stopped.
Correct. And again, I know that appellant's oral argument didn't focus on the reasonable articulable suspicion, but an objective basis exists so long as it's not a product of a mere whim, caprice, or idle curiosity. The officer didn't pull the appellant over on a whim here. They pulled him over in response to a 911 call. Someone was calling for help saying there's an unknown person in my garage with a gun. So not only was the reasonable articulable suspicion threshold crossed, at that point in time, there was probable cause to make an arrest. And the reason for that is because when the officers arrived, the facts from this identifiable caller who provided their name, their address, when they arrived, that information became corroborated.
I got to parcel that out. It seems to me I don't have any problem with the stop. There's a 911 call. The 911 call references a gun. Timberlake exists. The officers can make a stop under that. So I don't think there's any question about that. And as Judge Brodfeld noted, that there's corroboration that this is the right guy that they're investigating. I don't have any problem with that at all. I also don't have a problem with doing it as a felony stop because of the reference to the gun. I'm okay through all of that. Here's my concern. At the point that the officers purport to make an arrest, what is it that they have probable cause to believe that the appellant had committed by way of a crime?
The district court notes that there could have been numerous felonies that took place.
Could have been. I'm just asking for one that you can say on this record that there was probable cause to arrest for that crime.
The state's position is that the strongest felony that took place was a burglary. The caller explained that there was an individual inside of her garage. Now, she didn't personally observe this person with a firearm. She said her brother did.
Right.
However, she did personally observe this person inside of her garage. So she sees this person in the garage. She clarifies, this person is not known to me or people in the residence. That was what was communicated to the dispatcher. So there's a person inside the garage without consent. It's a reasonable inference given that this person is calling 911 for help. There's a person that's not known to her. They're inside a residential garage. And now the brother has said that this person is brandishing a firearm. So the intent to commit a crime, again, is it's reasonable that if there's a stranger in your garage brandishing a firearm, that he has an intent to commit a crime. Again, this is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The appellant was not charged with a burglary. However, at the time that the officers made the decision to arrest, it was reasonable given those facts.
To think that he was intending to commit a crime in the building?
Yes.
What crime?
The officers hypothesized that they were responding to a robbery, which he could have been there to rob someone. In addition, an assault. It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The state concedes that. It's whether there's sufficient probable cause to believe that a felony happened. And then it is very clear that this is, as the court just noted, that this was the right guy that they were looking for.
There's no question about the reasonable suspicion and to the cause to investigate whether there was a burglary in process. I agree with you 100% about that. But I'm having a hard time figuring out what there was probable cause to believe, what crime there was probable cause to believe that the appellant had committed at the point that they arrested him.
I just echo my statement that I believe that the burglary is the best in terms of those elements. And again, the elements are entering a residence without permission with the intent to commit a crime. I'll note too that being in possession of a weapon and being inside a residence while others are present enhances that crime. So
I don't know. I'm not sold on the notion. I'm okay with Timberlake because it exists, but there are people, myself included, who have authorization from the state to carry a weapon, and I don't think that that amounts to probable cause to arrest me.
Absolutely, and in I just want to note that in Timberlake, the caller called and simply said someone had a weapon that fell out of a car at a gas station, I believe.
Yes.
So here, the conduct was much more egregious because there's a person that is unknown to the residents of a house that has made entry into that house and is carrying a firearm. That is much substantially differentiated between those facts and the facts in Timberlake. It's a much more egregious criminal conduct.
Seems like the officers could have said, what were you doing in the garage before they arrested him? Or did you really have a firearm? Are you eligible to carry the firearm? Seems like there could have been some more investigation that might have led to probable cause.
There was additional investigation. Again, the state's position is that there was probable cause at the time of the arrest. There was an additional investigation that went on after the fact. Some of that investigation was cited to by appellant, again, in the state's position, inappropriately. But that illuminates a little bit why the appellant was not charged with any of these enumerated felonies that we've been discussing. It's simply that he had probable cause, again, which is a substantially lower standard than proof beyond a reasonable doubt for that arrest. And at the time, the officer's responding that this person is in a garage. It's inferable from the facts that this person does not have permission to enter this residence, and they're brandishing a firearm. I think it's different than the court's concern that, of course, the right to bear arms is a constitutionally protected right. But being in someone else's residence without permission with a firearm shows a criminal conduct. It shows the intent to commit a crime.
Let me move to the vehicle search. Next, they've made an arrest, right?
Correct.
Now, the warrantless search of the vehicle is because the officers claim to have probable cause to believe that there's going to be contraband or evidence of a crime found in the vehicle.
Correct.
We've already talked about what crime, and it certainly can't be just the presence of a gun, right?
Well, it's the presence of a gun that was used in the commission of a crime.
But you have to connect the gun to a crime, because you could find a gun in my, not today you couldn't, but you could find a gun in my vehicle. That's not probable cause that any crime, evidence of any crime.
No, Your Honor, but I think we're circling back to whether or not the court believes that there was probable cause for that lawful arrest. Because if the court believes that there's probable cause for that lawful arrest, that means that their commission of a crime has occurred.
So
and there therefore is probable cause to believe that that gun is in the car. And I just want to lay out a little bit, some facts to support that.
But there's no additional evidence besides the probable cause to have arrested him to believe that there's going to be evidence of a crime in the car, correct?
There's some facts to support that there's a gun in the car.
Right, but the gun in the car, I think we've established a gun in a car standing alone can't be a probable cause to search. Unless you know he's ineligible.
First of all, there was testimony that the officers were confident that he was ineligible to possess, number one. Number two, if it was used in the commission of a crime, in the sense if the court accepts that there was probable cause to arrest, meaning a crime had been committed, then it was reasonable to believe that that gun was in the car because it was not on his person. And the testimony that came out during the contested omnibus hearing, Lieutenant Sturgeon said, prior to searching that vehicle, we were in contact with assisting officers who said, we're making initial contact with the reporting party and other witnesses, and they're adamant that there's a silver revolver in that vehicle. Lieutenant Sturgeon then went on to say, a silver revolver actually sort of a unique weapon. He said in the 70s and 80s, it was more prevalent. And now that's sort of a specific thing, which enhanced his reasoning to think there's a gun in that car.
When did they know that he was ineligible?
As soon as he was identified. And that does get fleshed out in the transcript. So he is taken into custody. He's put into cuffs. After he's cuffed, I believe Officer Mandel locates his wallet. It's unclear whether he's verbally identified or it's through the access to his wallet, but after he's identified, Lieutenant Sturgeon then recognizes the name.
So before the search?
Correct. Correct. And I did point that out in my brief that there was at the time that he was identified, there was an additional probable cause to arrest for felon in possession. Because he said, Lieutenant Sturgeon said, based on prior police contacts with the appellant, he was confident that he was ineligible to possess. And the court noted that that testimony was credible, Your Honor. On the issue as it relates to the sentence, the second issue outside of the Fourth Amendment, I just wanted to briefly, appellant is arguing that there was a miscalculated criminal history score. Five of the points are uncontested. So the issue is whether the misdemeanor point was calculated incorrectly. The state's position is that it was calculated correctly pursuant to the Minnesota the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. I'd specifically point the court to section 2B6B. The appellant's argument doesn't hold water simply because the crime that we are here on appeal on is a controlled substance crime in the fifth degree, which is not enhanced by the prior gross misdemeanor domestics. If this was a domestic felony, then it would be inappropriate to use those gross misdemeanors both to enhance the felony and to use as a misdemeanor point. But here,
because they're an element of the crime.
Correct. And here it's a drug crime. So it doesn't hold up. I will not read the Minnesota sentencing guidelines in its entirety, but
I believe your brief includes the citation.
Okay.
Counsel.
I can see that I have 15 seconds here. I have nothing further unless the court has additional questions.
No, we do not. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I have 4 points I'd like to make. First, counsel for the state identified burglary as the strongest of the crime for which they had the strongest evidence. As Judge Rodenberg pointed out, there is no evidence of what crime they believe Mr. Heiderscheid was intending to commit. Absolutely none. They can point to none. And the investigation conducted by officers quickly disproved that Mr. Heiderscheid had committed a burglary. Second, as to the issue of what facts can be considered by this court.
At what point in time do you think the omnibus hearing establishes that no crime had been committed in the garage? At what point did the officers receive information based on the evidence at the omnibus hearing? I didn't say that very well. I'm sorry. I hope you understood me.
So I think if I understand Your Honor's question, it happens almost immediately when two officers go to the scene to speak with the individuals that are at the residence.
Because as you're indicating, there were multiple officers. Some were with Mr. Edwards in the parking lot with the vehicle, and some were back at the scene talking to the individuals there.
Correct.
So you're telling me, when did they learn that there was no crime in the garage?
So, again, we don't temporally know when it happened.
I read the record, is that we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know in the record. But what we do know is that officers only searched the vehicle after Mr. Heiderscheid had been taken to the station, and the other officers at the scene of the 911 caller's residence had conducted interviews. And the only person during those interviews that could provide any information about the gun was the brother, because he's the only person that actually saw the gun. And he would have said, I spent the morning with the guy, right? I know him. He was here with me all morning long. Because we know that that's what ended up in the police report.
So you're referring to the brother's consent.
Correct.
For Mr. Edwards to be in the garage, and that gets you out of burglary.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And that happened, I mean, it had to have happened in a pretty short period of time, because we know officers had that information before they searched the vehicle.
But from your description and from my reading of the transcript, it sounds like that information came to the police at some time after Mr. Edwards went to the police station.
Mr. Heiderscheid? No, Your
I'm
Honor.
Sorry.
The record is very clear that
I'm saying the wrong name.
The record is clear that they had that information before the vehicle search, because they're communicating with one another,
right.
and it is the description of the firearm that provides Lieutenant Sturgeon with his basis, his explanation for why he believed a gun would be found in the car.
They took Mr. Heiderscheid to the police station before they searched the vehicle, didn't they?
Correct.
That's my reading of the transcript.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt your 4 points.
Oh, no, that's fine. But to the, this actually ties in that I do believe that the court can, Lieutenant Sturgeon's testimony shows that there were individual officers at the scene conducting an investigation contemporaneously with the initial arrest of Mr. Heiderscheid. I believe under State v. Harris, it is clear that the court can look at not only the testimony that is at the omnibus hearing transcript, that is in the omnibus hearing transcript, but also the police reports that were submitted as a part of the stipulated facts. As to the identification issue, Lieutenant Sturgeon testified that he did not know Mr. Heiderscheid's identification before Mr. Heiderscheid was searched. He did not, and that's on page 31 of the transcript.
But did he know it before the vehicle was searched?
Yes, but he only knows it as a result of an unlawful search incident to arrest. He only knows who Mr. Heiderscheid is as a result of the unlawful search of Mr. Heiderscheid for identification. And he testifies. When you first...
He would have made an investigatory stop, mm-hmm. and I would assume he would have, as part of the investigatory stop, figured out who he was.
But that's not what happened here.
Well, it isn't what happened. It's probably what would have happened, though.
I mean, we don't know, because officers didn't employ those procedures.
Well, if he didn't even find out who he was, what would the investigation have been?
Perhaps a questioning between the two parties about what had happened in the garage. I mean, there was a lot of confusion. Mr. Heiderscheid said that a gun had been pulled on him by the brother and the brother's associate. And then finally, again, and this goes to the vehicle search, at the time, and we've discussed this, but at the time that officers searched the vehicle, they know that they are only looking for a gun because they've received information from officers on the scene that there was no other crime that had been committed, or no crime that had been committed. And I see that I'm out of time. Again, we believe that officers reversed the proper order of authorities in this case. They should have conducted an investigation before they arrested Mr. Heiderscheid. They did not. We respectfully ask that the court reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Heiderscheid's motion to suppress and, pursuant to the party's agreement, vacate Mr. Heiderscheid's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel. The matter was well-briefed and well-argued. It's now submitted to this court for our decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. So that concludes our oral calendar for this morning, now afternoon, and the court is in recess.
You did a really good job.
Thanks. Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you.